It is Tuesday, July 26th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. In the next half hour, it's day two of the Democratic National Convention, and we'll have a live report from Philadelphia on the party's efforts to rally behind its presidential nominee, Hillary Clinton. Another violent attack on civilians in Europe, this time targeting a French church. We'll find out how strong a role the Islamic State group is playing in these recent assaults. A solar plane completes a record-breaking round-the-world journey without using fuel, and we'll have a review of the latest science fiction hit film to hit the U.S. theaters.
And I love what J.J. Abrams has done with these last couple of movies, because he's really captured the spirit of Star Trek. And if you're a fan, you know what I'm talking about.
Well, it's all ahead on International Edition. Well, the Democratic Party is wrapping up its official nomination of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to be its candidate in November's presidential election. That nomination process got underway Tuesday evening, involving U.S. states and territories who participated in a roll call vote reflecting the results of their primaries and caucuses from earlier this year. Clinton faced a tough challenge in those contests from Senator Bernie Sanders. Well, our correspondent Doug Bernard is following the convention for us in Philadelphia and joins us on the line. Hi, Doug.
Hi there, Michael.
So what is the latest?
So this is really, if you're a politics geek like me, this is a genuinely exciting moment. The roll call vote is going on right now. Representative Keith Ellison is on the floor from the state of Minnesota. He's casting their votes for Senator Sanders, Senator Clinton. The tally right now is standing at Senator Sanders about just shy of 900 votes, and Secretary Clinton just shy of about 1,500 votes. Of course, Secretary Clinton has this wrapped up, and this is, you know, this is a formality, but this is a beloved formality. The actual nomination, her name was put into nomination today by Senator Barbara Mikulski, who actually, interestingly, was the first woman to be elected to the United States Senate completely in her own right, not to, like, inherit the seat when her husband passed on. And she's still the longest-serving woman senator. So it's a very exciting moment, I think, for the Democratic Party right now. Once all this is passed, this is kind of the classic hoopla of a convention. We get on to really what is going to be the business of the convention, which is this night and then the next 2 days. That is introducing the public once again to Hillary Clinton, even though you'd think everybody knows who she is by now, but the Democratic Party is going to try to brand her, to stamp her, and to
right.
put their message on her.
Well, just before we get to that business, how much of a distraction is the ongoing opposition
yeah.
of some Bernie Sanders supporters to Hillary Clinton being the nominee?
You know, there are boos, and then there are boos. I think we've seen dissension both in Cleveland at the Republican convention and here in Philadelphia. Certainly the first night when the hall was, delegates were even booing the invocation, for heaven's sakes. So it was, you know, a bit of a raucous night. Now, but there are differences. There are more than twice the number of Democratic delegates at the convention than there are Republican delegates. Traditionally, and I've covered this, is my 11th convention now, it's always the case that the Democratic convention is more rowdy. And interestingly, what we saw last night in Philadelphia with the Democrats, a lot of that display of anger, frustration, we wanted Bernie to win, that kind of thing, that's exactly what's supposed to happen the first night of a convention. You kind of get all that frustration out so you can get down to the other business of moving forward, moving the party forward. I think that's one of the mistakes the Republicans made. That should have been their first night. Senator Ted Cruz, put him on, you know, let everybody kind of get it all out of their system, and then
right.
go about the business of selling the Republican platform and the Republican candidate. They didn't do that. And I think the divisions on display in Cleveland with Republicans are deep and
okay.
lasting. I think what we're seeing here in Philadelphia, and you're seeing almost none of it today, by the way, is momentary frustration and disappointment, and that passes.
So perhaps that frustration of the Sanders supporters is becoming something of the past. But thank you very much to our correspondent, Doug Bernard, in Philadelphia. Okay, it's time now for our social media segment. As always, G. Abby Lee is with us in the studio to tell us the online reaction to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael. Hashtag DNC is the most widely used hashtag on Facebook and on Twitter. Hashtag Dems in Philly and hashtag Dem Convention are both being used. The roll call for a presidential nomination is underway right now. And so far, Hillary Clinton is ahead of Bernie Sanders. That's not surprising, given that Sanders already asked his delegates to vote for Clinton. What many people do find surprising, at least online, is that the number of delegates Sanders is getting is quite high for someone who already endorsed somebody else. People are also mentioning Clinton's husband, former President Bill Clinton. That's because he is scheduled to speak later today.
Well, gee, apart from Senator Sanders, we have New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, and First Lady Michelle Obama receiving positive responses from the media for their speeches last night.
Mm-hmm.
What's the online reaction like to that?
Well, GOP nominee Donald Trump has been tweeting about the Democratic event, and his tweet about Senator Booker is getting quite a bit of attention on social media. Trump tweeted, "If Cory Booker is the future of the Democratic Party, they have no future. I know more about Cory than he knows about himself." Now, during an interview with CNN Tuesday, Cory was asked what he thinks about the tweet, and he answered, "I love you, Donald. I pray for you. I hope you find some kindness in your heart." And many of his supporters found that to be a classy response.
What else are people talking about in terms of this convention today?
A celebrity campaign against Donald Trump is trending on Twitter, and it's called hashtag United Against Hate. Well-known celebrities like Julianne Moore and Kerry Washington joined the forces, which is a campaign on the moveon.org. Michael, back to you.
Thanks, Gene. Of course, Trump and his people don't like being called hateful. In fact, they reject that label. But thank you very much to G. Abby Lee. You can find her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. And I'm on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. And of course, you can find our show there as well. It is at VOA_IE. Well, earlier Tuesday, I co-hosted our weekly hashtag VOA TV show, which focused on the big role played by social media in this election campaign. In particular, we looked at how social media have helped Democrats and Republicans to spread their message, and how those sites also have provided critics of both sides with a platform to express their views. I spoke via Skype to Ian Walters of the American Conservative Union in Washington and to Drew Courtney of the liberal group People for the American Way in Philadelphia. I asked Courtney whether the Sanders supporters who booed Clinton on day one were drowning out her social media appeal, that is, drowning out the social media appeal of Hillary Clinton for party unity.
I don't think that that's really the case. I mean, I do think that they are making themselves heard. And I was in the hall last night, and, you know, there were 5,000 people, 6,000 people in the hall, and a relative handful of them were able to really push a message that, you know, I disagree with. A lot of other people did. That said, I think the message that came through from last night was really loud and clear. I mean, there was, to my mind, more conversation today about Michelle Obama's address than there was about the Bernie. Now, other people may have a different opinion about that, or the Bernie or bust folks. I actually think that what we have is just that there are competing messages. I think that the Democrats were able to put out a very strong message about why they believe Hillary Clinton is the strongest candidate. And the reality is that there will never be a time when there aren't competing messages going forward from any kind of convention like that. That's not a failure on anyone's part. That's just the new reality we face.
And I want to get Ian's perspective here. Ian, here in Washington, what do you think about some of the competing messages that came out of the RNC last week?
You know, they did okay as far as message control. I think the Ted Cruz opposition movement pales in comparison to what we saw last night from the Bernie or bust folks. So I think a lot of Republicans and conservatives are looking at the coverage of the DNC last night, whether it's the chant from the Bernie supporters saying lock her up, are really disappointed with the mainstream media coverage. When you see them going after, how could the folks on the floor at the RNC in Cleveland last week possibly say something so mean-spirited? And then to see the Bernie or bust folks do it, shout exactly the same words, I think it raises awareness of a certain bias that happens. The good thing about social media is that it sort of democratizes the way that people are able to speak to one another. Instead of going to the liberal newspaper, the conservative newspaper, using these hashtags, the RNC in Cleveland or the DNC in Philadelphia, it allows folks on the left and the right to interact with one another going around the media, and I think that's a good thing.
And that was Ian Walters of the American Conservative Union, along with Drew Courtney of People for the American Way. For more of that conversation, you can watch the full show on our website at voanews.com/#VOA and on my Facebook profile, Michael.Lippin. Well, here are some of the top stories on the VOA website right now. Islamic State group claims responsibility for Normandy church attack. Exiled Turkish cleric Gulen accuses President Erdogan of slow-motion coup in Turkey. South Sudan president swears in a new vice president to replace Machar. Pyongyang says U.S. would pay a terrifying price for destabilizing the Korean Peninsula. And 85 Russian athletes are barred from the Rio Olympics over doping. We have expanded coverage of those stories and more on voanews.com. This is International Edition. A news agency affiliated with the Islamic State militant group says two attackers who killed a French priest after taking him hostage at a church in Normandy, France, were soldiers of IS. French President François Hollande said the attackers had claimed allegiance to IS before being shot dead by police. Before those French police intervened, security officials said the two attackers had slit the priest's throat. Charlie Winter is a British terrorism researcher. International Edition's Sarah Williams asked him about the difficulty in determining whether a terror attack in Europe is connected to Islamic State or not.
It's incredibly difficult to say with any certainty whether an attacker is inspired, directed, or allied to the Islamic State, as you say. And I think it's critical that we really interrogate the difference between each of those things. But one thing that's for certain is that the authorities in the minutes and hours that follow an attack, it's very unlikely that they will know with any certainty themselves. And of course, after a tragedy like what happened today in Normandy or in Germany on the train with the asylum seeker from Afghanistan or indeed Nice, there is, of course, this urge to rationalize what happened, to try and understand why it's taken place. And given that there are lots of attacks like these that have been claimed by the Islamic State in recent months, it's tempting to just think, yes, it must be the Islamic State. That's the obvious option. But precisely because it is the obvious option, we need to make sure that we reserve judgment and don't just be lazy and go for that. If we do, then we end up aiding and incentivizing attackers who are acting in the name of the Islamic State or attackers who are acting under the orders of the Islamic State. I think reserving judgment is absolutely crucial, and the media's role in this is paramount.
Because some are a lone wolf attacker who could say he was inspired by IS. However, whether he had any real contact with Islamic State or not sometimes is unknown.
Absolutely. And the telltale sign that there has been some contact is if a photograph or video message emerges. And that's a new modus operandi that the Islamic State has begun to use in order to make its mark on something, to show that, yes, this really was an attacker that was fighting on behalf of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's caliphate. Now, even that, I think it's important to recognize that this is an attack being adopted, to use the words of J.M. Berger. It's being adopted rather than claimed. The attack itself is something which is being incorporated into the Islamic State's overseas operation, but it's not very, very much not being claimed in the same way that, say, the attacks in Paris or Brussels were claimed. There's very little fanfare. There's the same formula of an insider source or a trusted source to the Islamic State has confirmed that these are soldiers of the Islamic State or something like that. And this is qualitatively different from an announcement that names the attackers, states very clearly what the operation was. Islamic State has become a lot more, in this sense, ambiguous in the way that it adopts these attacks.
And that was terrorism researcher Charlie Winter in conversation with my colleague Sarah Williams. Well, after 17 months and 42,000 kilometers, The Solar Impulse 2 plane returned to Abu Dhabi early Tuesday, completing the first round-the-world trip of a sun-powered aircraft. Two pilots took turns guiding the craft on its voyage, Swiss explorers André Borschberg and Bertrand Piccard, to demonstrate the potential of renewable energy. Ron Bishop is an aviation lecturer at Central Queensland University in Australia. Here's what he told VOA's Victor Beatty about the achievement of Solar Impulse 2.
It's a game changer. So what this says to us is that we can do it, just like the first flight that the Wright brothers did. It says we can do it, and then from here, it'll just be an expansion. So if we can fly around the world not using any internal combustion engines or exchanging dead dinosaurs into smoke, what that does is it makes it where we're not polluting and we're able to sustain a flight and still get someone somewhere. And then all we have to do is just increase the speeds and increase the payload, and we'll be able to do it with people on board. And who knows, even maybe a small engine to have as a backup.
Ron, unfavorable weather grounded it sometimes for months at a time. Is that something right. that can be overcome?
Yeah, look, as it's just like anything. You know, when the mobile phones started, they were big bricks, and now they're real small. They're about the size of a small wallet now. So the same thing will happen. They'll get bigger, better, more payload, able to withstand more weather conditions. And the other thing, too, is the good part about this, it proves that we can do around the world. So now going from, say, New York to Paris won't be as big of a demand. That'll make it where we can definitely do that. And it'll just be having to work in a backup system to the electric. But, boy, what a feat. That's just amazing. I mean, we're using energy from the sun real time power flight to move us somewhere. You couldn't ask for better than that.
The propeller-driven aircraft's four engines are powered exclusively by energy collected from more than 17,000 solar cells built on the plane's wings, excess energy stored in four batteries during daylight to keep the plane flying after dark. Is this something that also can be overcome?
Yeah, that can. And what we could probably see is a hybrid. So possibly an aircraft that takes off with the jet engine, and then once it gets to altitude, it can run on the solar or on batteries. And then when it goes to descend, well, when you're descending, you're not using any energy, you're using gravity. So I could definitely see us doing that, especially for the longer flights. And you're seeing that. You're seeing Airbus has created a small aircraft that was able to cross the English Channel, and then I believe that goes on sale next year, 2017. So people will be able to buy that for flight training, and that's 100% electric as well. And it really protects the environment or enhances the environment, doesn't take anything away from it, and we can make it where we can get places, because that's what we want to do is move around.
And that was Ron Bishop of Central Queensland University speaking to International Edition's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
California scientists are finding that teaching music to young children can speed up their brain development, especially in the areas of the brain that are responsible for processing sound, language development, and reading skills. Researchers from the University of Southern California have been monitoring the brain development and behavior of 37 children living in underprivileged areas of Los Angeles. 13 of the children receive music instruction from a program sponsored by the Los Angeles Philharmonic. 11 children are involved in a community soccer program, while the remaining 13 children aren't involved in any particular after-school activities. The initial study results published in the journal Developmental Cognitive Neuroscience shows that the auditory pathway in the brains of children involved with music education is maturing quicker and is more efficient than those who don't participate in the musical program. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. It was a big weekend for movies across the United States, including the long-awaited Star Trek Beyond. My colleague Lori London discussed those new summer movies with Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard and started by asking him whether Star Trek Beyond lived up to the hype.
Well, you know, I'm a huge Star Trek fan, and it's so funny. I'm a Star Wars fan, too, and I was a little boy. Star Wars came first because you have to have a certain kind of maturity to understand Star Trek, because it's based in scientific fact,
you know, all scientific principles and also the metaphors, you know, about unity and boldly going where no one, man has gone before, like Gene Roddenberry wanted. So, and I love what J.J. Abrams has done with these last couple of movies because he's really captured the spirit of Star Trek. And if you're a fan, you know what I'm talking about. And this latest edition, Star Trek Beyond, does exactly that. It's a glorified episode. And I say that, you know, with all excitement and respect to the original series. And we have the Enterprise that crashes on this planet, and this alien race is bent on destroying the Federation with this ancient weapon. And the main villain is named Krall, and it's Idris Elba, and he's this lizard-like creature. And that's what's really cool also about this new Star Trek edition is that they go back to the basics. So I know there's a lot of CGI in the movie, but they also go back to the real makeup effects like they did in the olden days. So you see these creatures walking around the ship and on this planet. It's not a special effect. That's the real makeup. And they also pair up all of our characters. They have to abandon ship, and you have Kirk and Chekhov together, and you have Bones and Spock together. So you have all your favorite characters paired up. There's humor, there's excitement, and at times, it's just really great to see the franchise back for the 50th anniversary. I love it. It's one of my favorite movies of the summer, if not one of my favorite movies this year.
Wow.
Is that an endorsement or what?
That's a big, that is a big endorsement. And there's another movie out that just came out that you saw, a horror that I definitely would be afraid to see, Lights Out.
Well, I was one of those kids that was afraid of the dark. I had the nightlight. I thought something was underneath the bed that was going to get me if I moved out of my covers. And, you know, and that's what this movie plays on. Lights Out plays on because there's this entity that can only exist in the dark. So if you turn on a light switch, it disappears. If it's in the light anywhere in the house or anywhere it's existing, it won't come out. So that's what it plays on. And the movie, there's a lot of light switching going off and on because you see the creature and then you turn off the light, you know, off and on. So it's always like playing with you, you know, on your senses. And this was an internet movie. This was on YouTube and on the net for like a 4-minute short film from the director. And James Wan, who produced, you know, The Conjuring and all those popular films, he saw this film and went to the filmmaker and said, I want you to make a full-length version of this. The movie opened $30-40 million, and it only cost $5 million. So this has a tremendous return. It's PG-13, so younger kids can go see it. It's not a gory film. It just plays on your fears of this creature that lives in the night that's terrorizing his family.
And that was Jeffrey K. Howard speaking to Lori London. That's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. Join us again at 0330 Universal Time. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. We'll catch you later.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
We now have momentum in this fight against ISIL and clear results on the ground. That is the assessment of U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter in a speech to the Counter-ISIL Foreign and Defense Minister meeting. Together, he said, we are going to destroy the fact and the idea of an Islamic State based on ISIL's barbaric ideology. The coalition's military campaign plan has three objectives. First, to destroy ISIL in Iraq and Syria. As recent attacks make clear, ISIL's safe havens threaten not only the lives of the Iraqi and Syrian peoples, but also the security of people around the world. And the sooner ISIL is defeated in Iraq and Syria, the safer everyone will be. But while it's necessary to defeat ISIL in Iraq and Syria, it is not sufficient since this ideology can, and in some cases, such as in Afghanistan and Libya, has spread. The second objective is to combat ISIL's metastases everywhere they emerge around the world. And the third objective is to support diplomatic, economic, homeland and border security, intelligence, and law enforcement to protect innocent civilians at home from terrorist attack. A key aspect of the coalition military campaign plan is to identify local forces who can deliver ISIL a lasting defeat with coalition support. Only local forces can deliver and sustain such a defeat, said Secretary Carter, since it is such forces who must hold and govern territory after it has been retaken from ISIL and restore a decent life to the people who live there. The coalition has pursued a plan to accelerate ISIL's lasting defeat. A year ago, the entire campaign in Iraq and Syria was put under the single command of Lieutenant General Sean McFarland. And since then, the campaign has advanced, squeezing ISIL and rolling it back towards Raqqa and Mosul. By isolating those two cities, said Secretary Carter, we're effectively setting the stage to collapse ISIL's control over them. Together, said Secretary Carter, we will deliver ISIL the lasting defeat it deserves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.